Hello, friend. Thank you so much for downloading this podcast, and I hope you hear something truly, I mean this from the bottom of my heart, something that edifies, equips, enlightens, encourages, and then gently but firmly gets you out there into the marketplace of ideas. I so appreciate your taking the time to listen. But before you start the broadcast, let me just take a moment and explain that this month's truth tool is called SEEK, S-E-E-K, written by my friend David Robertson, my favorite Scottish apologist who is currently serving the Lord in Australia. He comes and visits with us once a month. And he wrote a book called Ask, and now he's written a follow-up book called Seek, Real Word Answers to Real World Questions. And so he literally goes through a whole series of questions like, is there ever a good lie? Or does the Bible have mistakes? Or what does the Bible say about climate change? Or what's the difference between capitalism and communism? And the list goes on and on and on. So it is a fabulous reference book that I know you're going to want to put in your legacy library. So if you'd like a copy of Seek, and we are listener-supported radio, I'd love to send one to you when you give a gift of any amount to support In the Market with Janet Parshall. Simply call 877-JANET-58, that's 877-JANET-58, and offer a gift of any amount. We'll send you a copy of David's book, Seek. Or if you'd rather do it online, go to inthemarketwithjanetparshall.org. Scroll to the bottom of the page. There's the cover. It has a brain on the cover, so you can't miss it. Click on the cover of the book, make your gift right through the website, and we'll send you a copy of Seek by David Robertson. Great tool to have, one of those important little volumes in your ready reference library, and I know you're going to be blessed. By the way, when you're on the website, you might want to consider being a Parshall partner. Those are people who give every single month at a level of their own choosing. They always get whatever the truth tool is that particular month. And in addition to that, they get a newsletter that contains an audio piece from me as well. So Parshall partner or just this month's truth tool, either way, it helps us financially to keep moving forward. 877-JANET-58, 877-JANET-58, or online at inthemarketwithjanetparshall.org. Now please, enjoy the broadcast.
Here are some of the news headlines we're watching.
By the time the conference was over, the president won a pledge.
So Americans worshiping government over God.
An extremely rare safety move by a nation.
17 years the Palestinians and Israelis negotiated.
This idea of Oshak is not
Hi, friends. Welcome to In the Market with Janet Parshall. Thrilled we are going to spend the hour together. Put on your thinking caps because we're going to need it this hour. We're going to think critically and think biblically. And that cacophony that represents the marketplace of ideas that you just heard, well, I guarantee you that a lot of people inside that marketplace of ideas are either advocating a kind of Marxist ideology or they're repelling against it and coming up with an alternative. And basically, our culture is being divided into two camps right now. There's very little middle ground on this because, quite frankly, water and oil don't mix. And there are two mutually exclusive worldviews that are fighting for predominance in the heart of every single human being in this country. And my guest would argue globally as well. This isn't a battle just being relegated to the fight for the human heart in the United States. It's a global issue as well. But my guest is brilliant, and he's very modest, and he won't say this, so I'm just going to brag on him. He's just a brilliant man. He is, I think, by gifting, he's a writer for sure, but he's also very much of a historian. And he has a quickening in his heart where he's cognizant of some of the shifts and the changes that are taking place in the world, and writes to us, the consumer, of what's happening in the marketplace so that we will be quickened to know how to respond. So he's just come out with a brand new book that I'm so excited about. It is stellar. It is timely. It is apropos for the days and age in which we live. And I'm so thankful that we've been given the gift of 1 hour of Mike Gonzalez's time. He is a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation. And while he's there, he writes on a variety of subjects like critical theory, critical race theory, identity politics, education, foreign policy. He spent the better part of two decades as a journalist, clocking 11 years at the Wall Street Journal, and he wrote from stations all over the world, quite frankly. He then joined President Bush's administration and worked in the State Department's European Bureau. In his very first foreign assignment, this man's life reads like a novel in and of itself. In his very first foreign assignment, Mike was arrested and expelled from Panama by the dictator Manuel Noriega. The following year, 1989, this is like Forrest Gump, okay? I mean, it's just amazing how his life goes on. He traveled with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, and today he devotes nearly all of his passion to defending the U.S. and the West in general from systematic overhaul and cultural genocide. He's seen it, he recognizes it, and he's fighting for the preservation of our union, our republic, as the woman said to Ben Franklin outside Philadelphia Hall. What do we have, sir? A republic, he said to her, if you can keep it. And there's a lot of evidence that that keeping is now more important than ever. So he, along with Catherine Gorka, Katie, as she's known to her friends, wrote a book called Next Gen Marxism, What It Is and How to Combat It. And this is a seminal text. One of the things that Mike does beautifully is he's a historian, as I say, and he writes the history of Marxism, where it was, where it is now, where it's going, and what we need to do about it. Mike, congratulations on a profoundly important book. I hope the feedback has been excellent. In fact, on that note, I'm not going to presume. Let me ask, what kind of feedback have you been getting on this book?
Hi, Janet. Thank you for that very nice introduction of me and the book that I wrote with Katie Gorka. It's been selling very well, actually. It was almost among the top 100 books sold in the world in the first week. And this, you know, is about Amazon sells about 34 million books. And it was number one in democracy and communism in the pretty good categories. So it's been very well received so far. Thank you for asking.
I am thrilled to hear that, and not the least bit surprised. And that also tells me something. If you dig down to causal effects, if people write it, it would seem to me that they would fall in one of two categories. They would be a Marxist, and they're worried about what you're going to expose, or they would, and I would guess that this might be the larger category, there are people who say something's wrong, something's broken. I might not know the history. I might not know the terms. I don't even know who the key players are. But things are not as they should be and not as they have been. And I think there are people who are saying, if I could identify it, then I could begin to rectify it. And my guess is that's why it's resonating so much. So let's talk about terms. When you talk about next-gen Marxism, obviously what you're intimating is that there has been an evolution in what would be known as traditional Marxism. Give us, if you would, the Cliff's Notes. So if I were to say, what were the hallmarks of Marxism as we originally understood it when we were taking our high school civics class versus what you would use as a term, next-gen Marxism? What are the distinctives?
So I would say that this is Marxism number three. The first one, then the Marxism of Marx, was an economically determinist Marxism in which economics was everything. You know, Marx wrote that man's class, his social class, you know, dependent on his relationship to the means of production, whether he worked with the means of production or owned the means of production, that changes in the material forces of production would determine the pace of revolution, et cetera. He wrote the manifesto with Engels, Friedrich Engels, his sugar daddy, in 1848, that sets down the rules of he was awful to Engels, by the way. He was an awful man, Marx. But he writes, you know, what communism and Marxism and socialism are in the 1848 manifesto. And then in 1867, he writes Capital, also known as Das Kapital by his German name. Marx wrote in German. And he, in these works and other works, he writes that the worker would be constantly rising up and rebelling and overthrowing the bourgeoisie, the owner of capital, you know, killing the bourgeois, raping his wife and daughter, getting rid of it. There would be violent revolution. You would have to have despotism for a bit because people don't like it when they take away their private property. Mm-hmm. And then. About, you know, none of that is actually happens. There's no successful revolution until for like 70 years, until the 1917 Russian Revolution that establishes the Soviet Union. And even then, that kind of violated Marx's own predictions that revolution would have to come in an industrialized state. Russia was not an industrialized state. It was kind of a backward part of Europe. And then communist ideologues began to ask, what is wrong? How come Marx was so wrong? And they came up with some answers. Wow. And I guess I'm hearing the music and I give you the next evolution of Marxism
after the break. You betcha. That's absolutely what a great way to start and a perfect place to take a break. Mike Gonzalez is our guest for the entire hour. What a gift for him to give us this time. Very excited about his brand new book called Next Gen Marxism, What It Is, and most importantly, How to Combat It. Back after this. What is a woman? What's the difference between capitalism and communism? Is there such a thing as a good lie? That's why I've chosen Seek as this month's truth tool. Get biblical answers to questions like these and more as you seek for truth in God's Word. Ask for your copy of Seek when you give a gift of any amount to In the Market. Call 877-JANET-58. That's 877-JANET-58. Or go to inthemarketwithjanetpartial.org. Mike Gonzalez is with us, senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He is a superb writer, journalist for over 20 years, and a tremendous author. His latest book is called Next Gen Marxism, What It Is and How to Combat It. So we've started by doing a kind of flyover of Marxism as we evidence its evolution from what it was with Marx originally. Marxism iteration one, the economy, economic revolt was the spinal column. Proves he was not a prophet. Things didn't turn out the way he did. That opens the door to the second iteration. Mike, where does that take place and how does it differ from the first iteration?
So what Katie and I say in our book is that the second iteration takes place beginning in the 20s, really catching speed in the 30s and flowers in the 60s, which is the cultural Marxist stage, which they said to themselves, well, Marxism did not turn out the way Marx predicted because man has cultural beliefs that that impede the progress of Marxism. It turns out that the worker so Marx believed that the family had to be abolished, the nation state had to be abolished, private property had to be abolished, and God had to be abolished. And the worker didn't believe in any of those things. The worker liked his family, worshiped God, was patriotic, and liked what private property he had. He just wanted more private property. So these then cultural Marxists say, the worker has false consciousness. We need to elevate his consciousness. We need to raise his consciousness in their parlance. We need to infiltrate the institutions and indoctrinate the worker and indoctrinate everybody. So let's do that by working through the culture. Then that comes to America in the 1960s. And that flowers here, one of the best known cultural Marxists, Antonio Gramsci, is translated for the first time into English and, fully translated. One of the best translators was Joe Buttigieg, the father of Pete Buttigieg, Secretary of Transportation. Pete Buttigieg talks about his father calling him an immigrant. And you get this idea that he worked at a factory, he brought a lunch pail. Actually, the factory in South Bend was Notre Dame. Where Joseph Buttigieg was a tenured professor and a Marxist. Wow. So to this then, we, after the 1960s, we in America add a great dollop of race and sex and union organizing and uniquely American features. And the worker is replaced as the instrument of revolution by members of what they would call the racial or sexual marginalized groups. And this was directly an impact from the cultural Marxists. Herbert Marcuse, one of the Europeans who brought his ideas to the United States in the 1960s, he notices the riots in the 1960s, and he says, and this is quoting him directly, that the revolution is going to come from, quote-unquote, the ghetto population. People of other races and other cultures, quote unquote, because the worker, as I said before, Janet, the worker had zero interest in overthrowing the established order. The worker wanted better working conditions. The worker of Germany and Italy and Ohio and Michigan wanted to have good factory conditions, wanted to have a week on the Jersey Shore, wanted to be able to work an 8-hour day and in a 5-day week. Had rational demands, but he was also rationally patriotic and pro-family. So then they started looking for a substitute proletariat is another word, the Marxist word for worker, and they come up with the members of the racial and sexual marginalized groups. And this is seen, and they use the same terminology. I remember at the beginning I said that Marx had talked in terms of the material forces of production. Gramsci, the cultural Marxist, says, popular beliefs and ideas are also material forces, uses the same wording, but to transfer that to a culture, to cultural issues. And then Eric Mann, a person who plays a leading role in the tale that Katie and I tell, he uses the same word, but he says, In a country as racist as the United States, racialization is also a material force. So they use the same terminology as they evolve. This is the baton passing from the economic Marxism of Marx to the cultural Marxism of Gramsci to the next gen Marxism of people like Eric Mann and the people the people that he impacts. So that's what we have today. All the crazy stuff that is happening over race and over sex and over climate and over Gaza, none of that is about Gaza or climate or sex. It's all about revolution.
Absolutely. You write something brilliant in the book. The use of race, sex, sexual orientation, climate, social justice, gender and animal rights, the denigration of beauty and the sublime, the consequent elevation of ugliness, chaos, and disorder, the dissemination of the family, and the abandonment of God. These and many other diverse struggles are fronts in a larger war. That describes the headlines of the day. That's exactly where we're at right now. So let me just ask you to wax philosophical for a minute. So if we see this devolution of Marxism, where ultimately it's the worker and it's economic revolt, and now we've thrown in not the worker, but people that are quote-unquote marginalized, although I think there's a supportive argument within the context of that as well into some of these categories as to whether or not they're marginalized, but they're going to use people as the chess pieces. Well, this goes right to what you've written about for years with eloquence about CT. You have to have an oppressor and you have to have the oppressed. It's never about getting rights for those that you've deemed to be, quote, the marginalized. In fact, if anything, in the ultimate act of hubris, arrogance, and self-aggrandizement, it's using these people as political tools to get what they want, and they don't care whether or not they're advanced or not. Am I right or wrong?
Oh, completely right. Completely right. And by the way, thank you for bringing up the part about the oppressor and the oppressed, because that comes from the very first page of the manifesto. So that doesn't change. That reduction ad absurdum of all of human interaction into the paradigm of the oppressed versus oppressor comes from the 1848 manifesto. I won't attempt to say it in German, but I have looked it up in the German original, and it's there. Marx writes, all of human history has to do with a history of the oppressed and the oppressor in an epic struggle. Wow. That hasn't changed.
And that's important to know, particularly with what we're seeing in the headlines of the day. Mike Gonzalez, this is a very important book. All of a sudden, you're going to read it and you're going to go, I'm not crazy. This is what I'm seeing. This is what's happening. But ever the optimist, he ends by letting us know that there are definitely things we can do to stem the rise of this next-gen Marxism, his brand new book. More with Mike Gonzalez, senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation, right after this. We have the privilege of spending the hour with Mike Gonzalez. He is senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation, where he writes on critical theory, identity politics, diversity, multiculturalism, nationalism. The list goes on and on and on. Spent close to 20 years being a journalist, many of those years at the Wall Street Journal, serving from foreign offices around the globe. And I'm so grateful that he continues to write, because his writing is superb. These are tomes, for lack of a better word. It really does an excellent job of laying out the history, time, date, places, references, so that you understand the history. But he also does a wonderful job of moving you through the evidence that leads to a solid conclusion. So his newest book, co-authored with Catherine Gorka, is called Next Gen Marxism, What It Is and How to Combat It. So let me, because I have the privilege of this hour with you, Mike, just kind of ask you to wax philosophical for a minute. So here's, to me, the paradox. Obviously, at its core, Marxism is a humanistic worldview. It's self-aggrandizement, even though it masquerades under the idea of collectivism. There's no belief in an objective moral code. There's no belief in objective knowable truth that applies to all people in all times and all places. It's abhorrent to the idea of God, because there would be a rule maker and there would be an accountability. So they don't want that. And yet, paradoxically, they identify themselves as utopians, which would be a place where, and every day and every way, I guess man is getting better and better. I'm sorry, could you just point me in the history of the world, of which you know much about, did a utopia ever occur anywhere? And if it did, is it still in existence today? And if not, why?
So I think you have just put your finger on a couple of super important points. One of them is this idea that one of the biggest differences, and I think we can speak, Janet, about us and them. I think we can speak about people who are listening to you right now, you, me, And then, you know, the Marxists left. It's that they don't believe in objective truth. Right. And we saw this most recently last week when all these past tweets came out from Catherine Marr, the new CEO of NPR, who says that, who spent, you know, she's like a parody of what a woke white woman, rich woman from Connecticut is. And she says, no, one of the things that's getting us into trouble is this adherence to facts and truth. And it stops us from doing things. And you and I believe that there is an objective truth. And you and I, well, you and I believe in a biblical God. You don't have to believe in a biblical God to be moral, I don't think. I've met people who are not, but even people who are not practicing Christians or Christians who are moral, they have admitted to me that yes, their morality, their matrix is Christian or Judeo-Christian rather. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to replace that matrix with another matrix all of their own, right, which says that human nature is changeable. I mentioned Gramsci before. He says that one of the biggest, one of the best things that Marx does is that he says that human nature is malleable. So the problem is, and they call this the new man, this search for utopia has to do with changing human nature, and which you and I also believe that man is fallen, that mm-hmm. that everything is imperfect, that everything earthly is going to be imperfect, you know, by its nature. When the new man, excuse me, I'm going to sneeze.
God bless you.
showing my imperfection. One of many of my imperfections. When the new man doesn't show up, they get very cross. And they have to start, you know, in instituting, you know, dictatorial practices to force old man to behave in certain ways, or at least keep quiet, or to have to use doublespeak. And this is what you have in socialist society after socialist society, that you have the oppression of men is the opposite of what they promise. You know, Saul Alinsky, who features prominently in the book that Kitty and I wrote, we devoted a chapter to, because this is a lot of next-gen Marxism is about community organizing, and Saul Alinsky is really the utmost in organizing here in the United States. He devotes his book, one of his books, to the devil. You know, he dedicates it to the devil, and he says that Lucifer. The reason he does that is because Lucifer is the first rebel.
Right.
Right. So that's the reason he must be praised. But he forgets that Lucifer actually establishes hell.
And that it's not going to turn out particularly well for him. So I'm not sure that's who I'd be dedicated. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. But you know, it's interesting about what you just said, this new man. First of all, the new man doesn't come by one's own volition. This isn't a choice. This is forced in a Marxist worldview. So in other words, you're going to have to be re-educated to become the new man.
Right.
So the idea of free will and liberty and freedom goes right out the window. But number two, the paradox, and they are so blind, is that the Bible talks about being a new man. When we enter into a relationship with Jesus Christ, the Bible says we are new creatures. And yet the idea of introducing God into their utopian self-generated world is anathema to them. So at its base, it's an abject ignorance about the condition of the human heart, that somehow the externals are going to change the way man does things. But yet they understand the impact of externals enough to say, well, but human nature is changeable. We're just going to change it for you.
Because God offers hope.
Right.
Religion gives us hope, and that hope is the last thing they want. They, you know, liberation, said Marcuse, could only come after man is aware of his own servitude. It's like the movie The Matrix. You must be aware that you are a slave, Neo.
Yes.
That you are a slave, Neo, you know, from that line in The Matrix. So they cannot have hope. Hope gets in the way.
Yeah, exactly right. Wow. The book is called Next Gen Marxism. It's about yay thick. It's absolutely rich, like a banquet meal. You're going to want to take your time reading it. But when you come away, you will be so the better for it, because you'll understand something you learned the first week sitting in philosophy class, right? Good ideas have good consequences. Bad ideas have altogether now. Yeah, bad consequences. So how do you defeat a bad idea? With a better one. And in next-gen Marxism, they come up with a lot of better ideas. Back after this. We live in a culture that's infatuated with the latest fads, but Ephesians 4:15 calls for us to be stable. No longer infants, Paul said, tossed about by the waves and carried around by every wind of teaching. On In the Market, we're exposing current trends and finding our balance by standing on the solid foundation of God's Word. To get exclusive behind-the-scenes information and benefits, become a partial partner. Call 877-JANET-58 or go online to inthemarketwithjanetpartial.org. I have been so waiting for this conversation with Mike Gonzalez, one of my favorite people. He's just very discerning, insightful, brilliant, and he's written a brand new book along with Catherine Gorka called Next Gen Marxism, What It Is and How to Combat It. And like his previous works, it is very much thought-provoking and I hope will be a clarion call to get people to start thinking correctly about ideas that are good and right and true. And part of that means identifying ideas that are anything but. Mike is, of course, a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation, a journalist for many, many, many years, served all over the world, served in the Bush administration, and the list goes on and on. He's one of the most humble people I've ever met, but he is absolutely brilliant. So I want to go to Saul Alinsky, because if you, in your beautiful flyover of the three iterations of Marxism, this is really sort of the launching point for this next-gen Marxism. So Alinsky writes the book Rules for Radical, 1971, the subtitle A Pragmatic Primer for Realistic Radicals, and the whole thing is how to successfully run a movement for change. And in it, there are some basic rules, and one of them is, and I found this interesting because we were just talking about your worldview. Either your worldview believes in objective, knowable truth that applies to all people, all times, and all places, therefore implies a rule giver, we would call him God, and the antithesis of that is I make up the rules as I go along, and somehow this ardent individualism works in the world that they favor, which is collectivism. That's an oxymoron if there ever was one. But going back to Saul, one of the things he makes is one of the rules, one of the salient points he makes is ridicule is man's most potent weapon. Now, as a journalist, you know that theoretically good journalism is about being objective and writing as the facts represent themselves. You know also that ridicule is usually the hallmark of somebody who's losing an argument. When you default to argument ad hominem, that great Latin phrase that means I no longer can discuss your ideas, so I'm going to go after you personally, it's why we're seeing the vitriol, the crudeness, the rudeness, the stuff that our parents would have been aghast to see in the behavior that's happening in the world today. And yet, at its core, this is all part of the game, if I can put it that way. Why did Alinsky think that somehow ridicule, which is really the hallmark that you're losing in this dialogue, why did he think ridicule was a potent weapon?
Because it is. You know, I tell people all the time to read Alinsky, not to do Alinsky, but to be aware of what they think and what they're going to try to do to you. You know, ridicule is a powerful weapon. It's also not a very nice thing to do to somebody. Mm-hmm. And to use that as a weapon is at the very least Machiavellian, mm-hmm. if not downright, you know, devilish. You know, but it is at the end of the day something that will reduce your enemy to size. So yes, they and all his rules are like that. By the way, you know, make the enemy play by his own rules, mm-hmm. etc. These are things that work. Alinsky was many things, but he was not dumb. He knew exactly. He was one of the first people who thought of organizing Mexican Americans, for example, in Los Angeles, back in the 1940s, but after the war. He worked with communists. He was against the in our book. Katie and I talk about how the new left had a terroristic stage in the 1970s. You had the weathermen. You had
the SDS,
the weather yep. on the ground. As mm-hmm. You know, SDS were protests, but they were not terrorists. You know, the weather on the ground was the. When SDS ceases to exist and mm-hmm. turns into a terrorist cell, you had the Black Panthers, also terrorists. You had the Symbionese Liberation Army, etc. Alinsky was against all that. Alinsky thought, and that failed. And Alinsky foresaw that. You know, Bill Ayers, Eric Mann, all these people were very bad terrorists. They never were able to subdue the United States or change the United States. Alinsky knew that, and he told them from the beginning, you guys are a bunch of college white kids who are not going to be able to change America in this manner. And it was only after they wised up and they came out from underground, people like Bill Ayers, to whom we devote a chapter, and realized they had to actually be Gramscian and take over the institutions and become professors, did they begin to change the country, not through terroristic practices. And Alinsky was very clairvoyant about things like that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So that takes us to the college campus, does it not? Because it's a kind of re-education camp in a different way. You make the point, and I think it's excellent, that what happens is that the Marxists of the 60s grew up, became the professors, and now they're the people who are training for the next gen Marxists, are they not?
Yeah, so Katie and I found this article by Felicity Barringer in the New York Times, of all things, you know, back in when the New York Times actually broke stories. And she was the former Moscow bureau chief. And she writes this prescient article, in, I think it was October 17th, 1989. That she goes, you know, Marxism is really kind of defeated in Eastern Europe and in the Soviet Union. This is, you know, the wall is about to fall, you know, within weeks after she writes this, literally 2 weeks later. And she says, but it's winning in American universities. You know, professors, Marxist professors have taken over. And she has another, you know, brilliant insight. She goes, and it's not in the economic faculties. It's in the humanities and in the law schools. And in fact, in 1989 is the creation of critical race theory. I forget what month. I forget if it had already happened by October or it had yet to happen. But critical race theory comes out of a meeting in a former convent in Wisconsin outside of Madison by a bunch of law professors who happened to be who were mostly African Americans, in one case a Mexican American, some Asian Americans, and they really, really begin to base opposition in terms of race, in saying that it's not just the rich that they're fighting, but white supremacy, and all these things. And so Barringer is like writing as a reporter. She's a good reporter, and she knew Marxism because she had been the Moscow bureau chief, and she writes all of this in 1989. So Katie and I use this article as a point of departure for what is about to befall us.
Yeah, exactly right, on the campuses. So this takes us to when we see the uprisings that are going on in campuses. I'm going to say the part out loud that a lot of people are thinking, and that is, I don't believe for one second, Mike, that these are organic. I think they're backdoor funded. They have the same signs. They have the same tents. They say the same chants. That just happens, really? That just kind of all happens automatically and organic like that? So the fomenting is coming from somewhere. And the fact that so often the genesis of these fomentations happens to be a college campus, doesn't that give evidence to what you and Katie are saying? That what Barringer was writing about, that Marxism has gone mainstream, is what we are seeing today?
Yeah, I've been seeing all day today what you're saying, that all the tents look the same. The signs are not hand-painted. The signs are very professional-looking.
Right.
Somebody's behind all this. But these ideas, the reduction of all of life to oppressor versus oppressor, versus oppressed, to the putting Israelis and Jews into the category of the oppressor, and saying, well, Israel is a white settler state, and putting the Palestinians, including the Palestinian terrorists, into the category of the oppressed. And that's why their terrorism must be forgiven and justified, just shows you how this comes from somewhere. Well, in that case, comes from the manifesto, but it's been taught to them by in schools, by professors who are teaching this. A lot of these kids who are demonstrating on behalf of Hamas and Gaza and all that may not know that they're Marxists, may not know that their ideas are Marxist, just like a person who's never read you know, John Maynard Keynes, who believes in deficit spending to rev up the economy, is a Keynesian. Mm-hmm. Or like when people quote Shakespeare all the time, which is what we do when we speak the language of English, we practice, you know, all of English is just quoting Shakespeare and the King James Bible. We may not be aware that we're doing that, but we are, because that's a cultural matrix within which we react today. So that is the same thing when these kids put and it has a really bad consequence, that they're approving and supporting and justifying, you know, the terrorist horrible things that happened on October 7th, because the Palestinians are the oppressed. All of this is cast in the language of critical race theory. I was reading today the dissertation of Malina Abdullah. I was reading that because she was just chosen as a VP candidate by Cornel West, who's an independent presidential candidate. And she is one of the founders of Black Lives Matter. So I went and read her thesis for the University of Southern California in 2001. And she quotes up and down, not just Karl Marx, but Angela Davis and all of the main writers of critical race theory. Maybe we can get into this in a future segment, but the reason why our lives are the way they are today is because of the riots of BLM in 2020 and the fact that many of the gatekeepers of our cultural institutions surrendered and accepted these fallacies that were espoused by Malina Abdullah, who led the protests, who led the marches, who one of the main founders of Black Lives Matter in 2013, who's completely influenced by critical race theory, which was completely influenced by Marx.
Right, right. And remember again, overarchingly, the goal here is to create a collective utopia. I'm not sure how denigrating your fellow man by blaming someone else, by making them the oppressed, gets you one step closer to utopia. So it's a failed idea that, Lord willing, will collapse under its own weight. When we come back, Mike, I want to ask you about the linkage between Marxism and sex, because that's going to be one of the areas where we're seeing this played out. Katie's talked about this, for example, like the transgender movement and Marxism. What's the linkage there? And then I want to know what we can do to make things change. Back with Mike Gonzalez right after this. We're visiting with Mike Gonzalez, senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation, where he writes on critical theory, identity, politics, diversity. The list goes on and on and on. His new book, co-authored with Catherine Gorka, is entitled Next Gen Marxism, What It Is and How to Combat It. So let me tease out this idea of the linkage so that my friends really understand what this is, why it's really here now, and then in many respects, why Berenger was right, why it's gone mainstream. So a lot of people listening all across the country right now might say, what in the world is Marxism, even in this third iteration, this next gen manifestation? How in the world does that intersect with the transgender movement across this country? So make that connection for us.
Well, that one is actually the one that is the most Marxist, I think, because it's the one that least defies the idea of objective truth. You know, they will tell you something that we have never needed to describe, which is what sex is. We all know as soon after we're born that they are men and they are women, and we don't need any further proof of that, right? And what they say is, like, oh no, that's not true. It's on a continuum. There's actually 57 genders. It keeps expanding to the point that it's LGBTQIA plus, because the English alphabet of 26 letters is not capacious enough to give us all the different iterations of what you can have. So this is not the first time. It's not – next-gen Marxists are not the first to use sex as a means to destroy the family, which is one of the things that Marx said had to be abolished, right, the family. Mm-hmm. And this has been another constant feature of Marx, the cultural Marxists of the 1920s, the cultural Marxists of the 1930s and so forth. And then for example, Edith Butler today and the queer theorists and the gender theorists, they all think that we must queer the family. Queer is a verb meaning to dismantle. And why is that? Because the family is the most basic unit of civil society, right? The family is pre-politics. The family is pre-state. When we were in caves, we had the family unit because of several, you know, because of the 9-month gestation period, the fact that, humans need a lot of help in the first few years is not like other mammals that can be left on their own pretty much after birth. They need to, or chickens and so forth. So we needed a mom and a dad. So they need to, if they're going to destroy society, if they're going to impose a new matrix, they have to destroy the family. And they discovered that the sexual urge was something that could be used to their advantage. So you had, for example, one of the few Central European revolutions that do succeed is the one in Hungary in 1919, but only succeeds really for like 300 days. And the cultural minister, George Lukács, who is also very important in this process of cultural Marxism, they begin to teach young children in Hungary sexual deviancy, you know, with a purpose, you know, to destroy the family. And then in 1957, Herbert Marcuse, one of these Europeans, has come to America, and one of his first breakaway bestseller is Eros and Civilization. And in it, he says that. He says it very explicitly. I want to get rid of the monogamous family. The monogamous family is something that stands in the way of revolution. So that is one of the main messages of Eros and Civilization. Mm-hmm. I mean, to the point that Marcuse is denounced by the Pope by name, something that has happened extremely rarely in the 2,000-year history of the papacy. Mm-hmm. And to the point that Black Lives Matter, so this continues on. One of the 13 main points of Black Lives Matter was destroying the Western-oriented nuclear family. And then, you know, at the height of the riots, my colleague Andy Olivastro and I pointed that out in a piece that we wrote for the New York Post in July of 2020. And when we reprinted it here at the Heritage Foundation, that piece got over a million views. So it must have gotten a lot more on the New York Post. And lo and behold, Janet, Black Lives Matter, like good Stalinists that they are, you know, airbrushed that out of, all of a sudden, the 13 principles were now 12. They got rid of that, except that they left it in other Black Lives Matter organizations. So for example, BLM Los Angeles still has it. If your listeners go to them, they will see that getting rid of the Western-oriented nuclear family is one of the principles of Black Lives Matter. So that is what stands behind the mutilation of young children, saying that yes, we can, and they hide this behind, you know, nice sounding words like gender affirming. You know, mm-hmm. Biden will repeat this. Right. By the way, Biden didn't believe in any of this for the many years that he was a politician. You mentioned my history, and you said that I have that in my bio, that in 1988 I was arrested, and in 1989 I traveled with the Mujahideen. I thought you were going to be here in the studio with me, so I brought you a copy of my very first opinion column for the Dallas Morning News. I have a full head of hair. In 1987, and that column is about Biden lying, you know, written 37 years ago, 37 years before Uncle Bozy.
Wow.
Amazing. And the cannibals.
And nothing new under the sun, as the writer of Ecclesiastes said. You know, I found it interesting when you talk about tearing down this idea of the Western concept of family. Actually, at its root, it's a very Eastern idea. You don't have to go very far into the book of Genesis to understand that before there was even sin in the world, God created family in his wisdom, knowing it was the cornerstone not only of culture, but of the globe. There are so many things at the back of the book that you tell us that we can do. One of them is to live within the truth. And I'm so glad that you and Katie included a quote from Solzhenitsyn, who said, "One man who stopped lying could bring down a tyranny." And one of the directives you challenge us to take up is to live within the truth. And I think that's imperative for us, not to be ashamed, always winsomely stating it, but nonetheless not being browbeaten into silence or submission, because we won't march in lockstep with their idea of educating us into the new man that they want us to be. Our new man or womanhood comes in that personal relationship with Jesus Christ. Mike, thank you so much. I feel like I barely scratched the surface. If I've gotten you interested, friends, I will have done my job. In my classroom, this would be required reading. Again, it's called Next Gen Marxism, What It Is and How to Combat It. I've got a link on my website. By the way, Mike is a prolific author, is constantly writing for Heritage, so I've got a link so that you can follow his excellent pieces there as well. I hope you've had something to really think about and to pray about and to thank God for that real precious liberty we currently enjoy in this country. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, friends. We'll see you next time.